Bé, doncs aquesta és la darrera taula. Per la gent que m'ho ha preguntat, les persones que estaven a l'illa Diagonal han arribat ja. No és un gag, és veritat. Un aplaudiment per elles. Sabia que tornaríeu. Bé, aquesta taula l'hem dit Rambla de l'Àrtic i perquè tenim una representació d'autors danesos, anglesos, però que les novel·les parlen, hi ha un true crime, hi ha dues novel·les, parlen de situacions, de crims, de fet, de personatges que viuen en els països nòrdics, que per nosaltres semblen una uniformitat, però que per ells, evidentment, tenen cadascú, cada país, cada societat, tenen les seves particularitats. Aquesta taula l'estarà moderada per la Carol Álvarez, que no només modera la taula, sinó que ha tingut molt a veure doncs, amb la construcció d'aquesta taula i l'anterior, i per això li volia demanar un aplaudiment per ella. Doncs deixo amb ella, amb el Mats Peder Norbo, us prego disculpes si dic malament el vostre cognom, Christoffer Petersen i Anthony Adain. Gràcies.
Hola, se'm sent bé? Bona tarda. Volia començar precisament aquesta xerrada posant-vos una mica en situació. Aquí tenim ara una temperatura, bueno, no dic aquí, dic a Barcelona, una temperatura que és de somni segurament pels nostres convidats, perquè clar, venen d'uns llocs molt més freds. I per posar-vos en situació, us recordaria que segons la temperatura que tenen a dia d'avui a Nuuk, que és la capital de Groenlàndia, estan a 5 graus sota zero, com a mitjana. 2 graus sota zero és com l'hora bona. És la capital de Groenlàndia, estem parlant. I a Reykjavik, que diguem que està molt més en una posició més càlida, estan a 2 graus de temperatura de mitjana. Enteneu, suposo, millor ara perquè la Lisa Reid, just abans, la primera dama islandesa, i la Irsa Sigurðardóttir, que estan firmant encara exemplars, estaven tan contentes d'estar aquí i de dir, oh, és que Barcelona sobretot és el clima. No és només el fred. Si coneixeu una miqueta el que pot ser l'entorn, perquè tothom més o menys té una idea, és el vent. Crec que a Groenlàndia, a la base aèria de Thule, que és a la zona més al nord que tenen, van aconseguir la xifra rècord de 330 km hora de velocitat de vent. I, clar, a sobre hi ha les nevades, hi ha el desglàs, hi ha els animals, hi ha els ossos polars. Tot plegat, insisteixo en que potser no és el clima de Barcelona el més fàcil per situar-nos, però sí que ens fan pensar d'entrada com és que aquests tres escriptors van decidir, sense ser d'allà, anar-hi. I voldria començar pel Anthony Adain, periodista de la BBC, que ha fet un true crime centrat en uns crims no resoltos a Islàndia. I que, sent anglès d'origen, va decidir anar-hi a investigar allà i muntar tota la seva obra més recent. Per què hi va anar allà?
Well, it sort of happened by chance, really, to begin with. I didn't know very much about Iceland going into it. I pitched an idea for a film about these cases 4 or 5 years ago. Was sent out there by a film company, and then the more time I spent in Iceland, the more fascinated I became by it. It was a country that I previously knew very little about. I don't think I even knew an Icelander. But the more time I spent there, the more enveloped in these cases I became, and the more obsessed by the country. It's a place with a fascinating history, very friendly people, and the most alien landscape imaginable. And the more time I was there, the more I wanted to go back.
Christoffer Petersen té una experiència ben diferent en aquest sentit, però ell també hi va anar per voluntat pròpia a un lloc com Groenlàndia, que com dèiem és bastant més extrem. Pots explicar-nos la teva experiència en anar allà? Perquè d'allà va sortir, a més, un llibre, que és el que tenim aquí, és un dels que presentem, Siete tumbas, un invierno. Christopher?
As a teenager, I read a lot of Jack London books. So the whole idea of the North and adventure was very important for me. But I met my Danish wife in Scotland, in the Highlands, where there's lots of mountains. We moved to Denmark, and I don't know if anyone's ever been to Denmark, but you can travel from Aalborg in the top of Denmark to Copenhagen, and the scenery does not change. It's just flat. And after a few years in Denmark, I just really needed to see something else. So we moved to Greenland in 2006. And Carol mentioned Thule Air Base, and we were living above Thule Air Base, 100 kilometers or so further north at one point. But it's about adventure and ice and snow and something a little different than flat, peaceful Denmark.
Una experiència similar segurament devia de tenir Mats Feder Nordbo, que és el nostre tercer convidat. Benvingut. Podries explicar-nos per què vas decidir anar-hi? Perquè tu, a més, hi vas estar treballant durant uns anys, fins fa ben poc, a la mateixa Nuuk.
Yes, actually, it was a wife thing, too. My wife got a job offer in Nuuk, and we were thinking, no, of course, we are not moving to Nuuk. That would be crazy. And then the next day, we were thinking, maybe we should try it. And the second day, we began to pack, and then we went to Nuuk, and I fell in love with the place instantly. So we should have been there for 2 years, and I was there for 4 years, and my now former wife is still living there.
Perfect. Allà et vas inspirar per fer la teva novel·la.
In Nuuk? Huh? Yes. The first year, when you're living in Greenland, you have to adapt to a lot of things that is so amazingly different from Denmark. You have to get used to isolation, and you learn to be lonely in a very beautiful way because you're so far away from the rest of the world and the environment, and everything is so different. So... But in the first year, I had so many things that I want to express, and then I started writing the book.
Ara parlarem ja directament de les vostres obres concretes perquè el públic pugui entendre una mica sobre què giren, quin és l'argument, més enllà del que és el paisatge. Sí que voldria, per retomar una mica el que ha estat la xerrada de la Ilse Sigurdardóttir, ella té una de les seves novel·les, encara no traduïdes, The Day is Dark, centrada en un viatge que fan uns islandesos precisament a Groenlàndia, i consideren que és com un viatge de qui vol anar a Groenlàndia quan estàs a Islàndia, no? I ho veuen com lo peor. Aquest tipus d'estranyesa del paisatge, de rebuig que pot arribar a sentir algú d'anar-hi i que a vosaltres, en canvi, us va convidar en el seu moment... volia que m'ho féssiu d'alguna manera traslladar a la trama de les vostres obres. La teva novel·la, per exemple,
yes,
com la podríem explicar?
My book.
Your book.
Yes. The beautiful thing about Greenland was not the only one thing that inspired me. I was in a sad way inspired by the dark numbers of Greenland through the dark sides, where a lot of girls are being abused, and we have a very high suicide rate, and that was one of the reasons that I started writing the book, because I want to gain focus on these areas. I was working at the town hall very close to the mayor, and I felt that I had to write something about these things. And then my main character in the book is a bit like me. He has moved to Greenland, and he's working at a paper. He's a bit more sad than I normally are, because he has lost his wife and daughter. And he's trying to find a new life in Greenland, and he's getting entangled in a case where there is a murder in the present time, and there are four murders in 1973, and the murders are quite brutal, almost like you would hunt a seal. And this my main character Matthew is quite fastly becoming more and more entangled in this case, and he joins up with a young Greenlandic woman named Dubana, who helps in solve the case, if you can say that. It takes a long time. And this Dubana is, in many ways, she is the main character, because she is the girl without skin. It's the book is named after her. Yeah. And she is a symbol of how it is to be a grown woman who had been abused as a child.
Mm-hmm. Faig un comentari només. El seu llibre en castellà es va traduir Los crímenes en el Ártico, però the original title was The Girl Without a Skin. The original title of your book.
Yes, the Danish title was The Girl Without Skin, uh-huh. In English.
Yeah. Okay. I el teu llibre? About your book?
I actually wrote about my main character in another series of books which happened before Sidis Hombas. And my main character, David Marazzi, is a very quiet guy, but he actually spoke quite loudly in my head, and he said, listen, I want my own novel. And I decided that he was quite interesting. So, but it's also very difficult because he says very little. So how he actually communicated that, I don't know. But I lived in the hunting communities where my wife worked in the hospital, I worked in the schools. And so between the two of us, we saw every different side of a small community in Greenland. And you can't help but be inspired by that. So Marazzi, my police officer, retired police officer, is really a hunter who stumbles into these criminal situations pretty much against his own will. But then he's a part of the environment. He's very close to the environment, but he's also very close to the people. And that was what I saw in the police officers that I had something to do with in Greenland. And when I worked at the police academy, I just met such incredibly professional Greenlandic people that I wanted to talk about them, because often in the media, you get a very different picture of Greenlanders. So I needed a strong character, and I found it in Marazzi.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about your book? It's a true crime thing, so it's a specific, different.
Yes. So it's a story from the 70s, so 1970s Iceland. It's Iceland's biggest crime. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I came to it in the first place. Iceland is a place with very little serious crime, as Jirsa and Eliza were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. So it's a story about these two men who went missing over the course of 11 months. The first was an 18-year-old who went out to a nightclub, and then he walked home drunk down this winding road through the lava fields, which are these kind of undulating rock formations which have kind of quite deep trenches in it. And he was walking back through a storm. Mm-hmm. He disappeared at 2 in the morning and was never seen again, and people kind of assumed he'd disappeared in a storm. And then 10 months later, a second man disappeared in a next-door town. He went to a cafe, came back home, his phone was ringing, his son heard him pick it up. He said, oh, I was just at the cafe, okay, I'll come back. He got back in the car and drove to the cafe, and that was the last time he was ever seen again. All that was found was his keys and the ignition. And so the book looks at these two disappearances and how this story kind of captured the imagination of a nation and ended up putting six people in prison who perhaps should not have gone.
Perhaps. We don't want spoilers. Okay? But we know that you have been involved too with the movie thing about the book.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so initially it was a film.
Yeah.
So I was working at a documentary company,
yes.
Took them the idea, worked on it for 3 years, going back and forth to Iceland, and about halfway through that process realised there was just a ton of material that we weren't going to be able to fit into a 90-minute film.
Mm-hmm.
So ended up writing a book alongside it, which goes into much greater detail about the cases and also kind of tells the story of Iceland, because it dovetails very closely with what happened in the criminal cases.
Mm-hmm. Això sí que és una cosa que voldria destacar. El documental que es va fer, en el que ell va participar i que té a veure amb aquesta mateixa true crime que té ara, està a Netflix, alguns de vosaltres igual l'heu vist, però no ha de fer-nos perdre la idea de llegir el llibre, en cap cas, perquè jo precisament vaig veure primer el documental i es deixa moltíssimes coses que explica, en canvi, el llibre, perquè el llibre fa una sèrie de comparacions amb el temps històric i polític que està vivint en aquell moment aquella societat islandesa que li donen un valor molt diferent i una profunditat molt més forta que la que té el documental, que està molt bé també, però que necessiten, jo crec, veure's com si fos un pack, no? La novel·la, i bueno, la novel·la, el true crime, i també el documental. En això crec que és important poder-ho destacar, perquè ja dic, tothom estem molt connectats i és important parlar-ne. Ara que ja coneixem una mica de què va cada història, sí que voldria establir com vincles entre les obres, tenint en compte doncs, el que dèiem, quan una són ficció i l'altra no ho és, una es passa a Groenlàndia, l'altra no. El que està clar és que, com aprofitant que estem en una de les taules rodones de Barcelona Negra, que està dedicada a la ciutat amagada, hem parlat de moltes maneres d'amagar, però el que tenen en comú tant el paisatge islandès com el paisatge de Groenlàndia és que tenen multitud de llocs i escenaris perfectes per amagar un cadàver, per començar. Realment, aquesta és una de les claus, per tornar amb tu, i ara continuem amb els companys, el misteri dels crims d'Islàndia és que no es van arribar a trobar mai en una illa on tampoc no hi és que hi hagi tanta gent. Són 300.000 habitants i tothom es coneix, vull dir, que no es pogués saber realment en un principi on estaven i que mai no s'hagi pogut saber on són els cadàvers. Explica'ns una mica sobre el paisatge, Antoni.
Yes, okay, so it's because it's such a, it's an island of such remote spaces with these kind of the perfect place to hide bodies, if you so wished. Immediately when the suspects were arrested, there were all sorts of different locations around Iceland where the police became convinced that they must have stowed these bodies. Yeah. So there's this amazing kind of red dust hill structure called Raud Hollow, which is just outside Reykjavik, where all of these suspects were taken by the police to search for the bodies. But when they actually went through the records on the night when these bodies could have been hidden, it transpired that the ice was so thick on the ground that they would have needed a pneumatic drill to get into the ground and actually bury those bodies. So time and time and again in this case, you have these kind of extraordinary landscapes where the police were convinced that these bodies had been hidden, but time and time again, the landscape proved slightly more difficult to understand.
I, Christopher, la teva novel·la té un títol que també té molt a veure amb les dificultats que té enterrar un cos. Pots explicar-nos per què té aquest títol? Siete tumbas, un invierno?
When I lived in a place called Umanak, which is an island, and it's got a heart-shaped mountain, which gives the island its name, I happened to walk past the cemetery, which is just a little bit outside of town. And it was at the end of the summer, and they were digging graves in anticipation of the winter. Because the problem is, when the permafrost comes, you need the pneumatic drill. You can't dig graves. So it felt a little bit like the undertaker was walking around town, sizing you up to see what kind of coffin you needed. So I saw them digging a number of graves, and I just thought, well, how do you decide? You know, is it seven? Is it eight? Do you need 20? Is there going to be a flu epidemic? Sorry, with coronavirus? So I remembered that. and I just thought that would be an interesting way of presenting a book and starting the whole concept of, well, you know, we're digging the graves in anticipation of someone is going to die. Is it going to be you? You don't know. So.
Mats, tu també tens, suposo, les dificultats de trobar algú perquè tens desapareguts a la teva novel·la.
I didn't really get it.
Sorry?
Difficulties finding people in Nuggets. You have to... Greenland is the size of the top of Norway to the bottom of Spain, and there are living 56,000 people. So it's quite easy to disappear there. And up till recently, they didn't really have records of people, so it was quite easy to disappear. Mm-hmm. And with all the ice and with all the half year of snow, it's a perfect place to kill somebody and get away with it. Yeah. And yes, it is. And if you're walking outside the settlements and the towns, then there's no internet and no phone connection and no roads, so it is just a perfect place to set a crime.
Mm-hmm. Explica una mica millor pel nostre públic això de que no tenen carreteres. Perquè això també és una de les grans idees, de les grans que a vegades costen d'assumir d'un país que no té carreteres.
Yes, it is. And each year many Danes go to Greenland and some of them quite fast they return because you have to get used to how it is there with no roads and poor phone connections in many places and the darkness and it is difficult because all these small settlements around in Greenland, they are not connected with anything. You can only go there by boat or helicopter often. And so it can be difficult to adapt to if you come from a country like Denmark where you used to have all kind of modern equipment like roads.
Bueno, una altra cosa deu ser de què hi treballes. Where do you work there? And you know, people work as hunters?
Oh, it's difficult because it's different. I mean, because in Nuuk, Nuuk is almost like Denmark, so people are having jobs like they would have in Denmark. But if you're going to the smaller towns and smaller settlements, it's more difficult because mm-hmm. many people in the settlement may have very, very poor schooling too, and very poor. There's not much to do in the settlements, so it is often hunting and fishing. Mm-hmm. And it, of course, makes another situation than it would do in a more modern town.
Mm-hmm. En els teus llibres el que he notat més en aquest almenys en aquest primer és la brutalitat que descrius. És molt brutal a l'hora de d'explicar els crims i no i crec que no és una brutalitat gratuïta. Crec que intentes buscar una arrel cultural en moltes coses que expliques.
The brutality in my books comes from Greenland is both a very beautiful place to live, but it can be a very brutal place to live too. Both nature likes to kill people, and a lot of bad things happens amongst people mm-hmm. too. So it is quite a brutal society. And but the way I ended up killing people in the first book is like you would do if you were seal hunting. So it is just a kind of the murder is used to hunting and guttering seals, and then the uh-huh. That's what he or she does.
I'm really sorry that I'm smiling when he says that.
No.
But I can just see the seal.
No. La identitat, la cultura del país, tu també la reflecteixes a la teva novel·la d'una manera una mica diferent. Fas unes al·lusions lingüístiques a la llengua, que són molt interessants. Podries explicar-nos com funciona el model lingüístic en allà?
As an outsider coming into a community, you quickly learn that if you're going to make any progress, you need to at least try to learn the language. Now, my character is called David Maratsi, but his Greenlandic name is Kistingatsak, which is quite difficult to say unless you've been practicing for a while before the panel. So I called him David. But the difficulty is that when you want to communicate with the people in the community, you can go really far by trying a few words. And then a few words become something more. And then suddenly you've got enough words to get into trouble, but not enough to get out of trouble, which makes for some interesting situations. But the more interesting than that is basically the book is inspired by a 2009 election when there was a political party who basically said, we are speaking Greenlandic in all our interviews, in all our media, anything that we do will be in Greenlandic. We're not going to speak Danish or English or any other language because we want to set focus or put focus on Greenlandic, a language and identity. But really what I wanted to address in my book was that there are a lot of professional people in Greenland who are Greenlandic. They maybe have a Danish parent and a Greenlandic parent, or maybe even two Greenlandic parents, but they've grown up in Nuuk, for example, where the only teachers they might have had have been Danish teachers, so they speak Danish. And me as an outsider often spoke more Greenlandic than some of the professional people I met. they were made to feel like second-class citizens during that election, and there was, you could feel that there was a split in the community. But we're talking about nurses and policemen, and I really felt that I wanted to address that, because language, moving to another country, you recognize how much language is a part of your culture, but them not speaking Greenlandic didn't make them any less Greenlandic. They still did everything that Mads has talked about.
Mads, explica'ns tu també la teva experiència en aquest sentit, perquè vau estar també un temps en allà i treballant-hi.
About this thing?
About this thing, yes. About language thing.
Yes, I have experienced the same things at the city council where I worked, and there were some of my colleagues who were Greenlandic but didn't speak enough Greenlandic for the ones who liked them too. No. So I have seen some of my colleagues been shouted at by the ones who call themselves real Greenlanders. But as I see it, the real Greenlands are a minority as it is now, and I believe the majority of Greenlanders are a bit more friendly and friendly toward Denmark too.
Fantàstic. L'islandès està més estès com a llengua a Islàndia, però l'anglès és la llengua vehicular pràcticament, vehicular, que tothom la coneix. Em suposo que no devies tenir tu aquesta experiència, no, a Islàndia, de dificultats amb la llengua o...
No, I mean, it was... It's a country where everyone we spoke to could speak very, very good English, which was a big help. I picked up some Icelandic, but I didn't get fluent. I wouldn't have been able to interrogate people about the complications of a criminal case. But the major benefit of writing the book through a production company and having Netflix kind of paying for the film is that they could pay for huge quantities of translations of all the court documents and confessions which made up the case. I mean, there's something like 10,000 pages worth of documents collected over the course of these cases, which lasted for kind of 45 years, kept on being reopened and reinvestigated, and are still being investigated today, 46 years on. So there's this huge paper trail of Icelandic documents, and without being able to speak kind of fluent, kind of legal Icelandic, or having the joys of Netflix to translate it all, it would have been very, very difficult to lift the lid on these things.
I think so. El xoc cultural que d'alguna manera, o la tensió que d'alguna manera afecta a Groenlàndia respecte a Dinamarca, que és aquesta que marca una mica la trama principal, no, de política que hi ha a la teva novel·la, Christopher, però que d'alguna manera està condicionant com has d'agafar-te la teva identitat i al mateix temps agafar-te els temps nous, segurament té molt més pes i està molt més marcat al teu true crime, Anthony, perquè realment tu estàs explicant una mica com una desaparició, dues desaparicions en els anys 70 es produeixen en una societat molt petita, però alhora molt sotmesa a la internacionalització d'aquella època, no? D'alguna manera va influir molt aquell temps polític, aquell context polític en què aquelles desaparicions de les que parles quedessin tan malament investigades, no? Com pot ser això? Com pot ser això? Explica'ns-ho.
So, 1970s Iceland was a place that had been quite isolated for a long time, especially compared to the rest of Europe. And at that exact moment that the disappearances took place, it was a time of very fast cultural and political change there. Drugs were coming to the country for the first time. There were the first reported incidents of people being arrested for marijuana possession. People were kind of growing their hair longer. The kind of swinging 60s had taken a bit of time to get over the Atlantic Ocean, but it was finally arriving. And these people who ended up getting arrested for these crimes really expressed this fast-changing society that was taking place in Iceland. They were viewed as being Charles Manson and his acolytes. You know, it played into this paranoia of outside influence coming into a country that until that point had been comparatively quite contained. Mm-hmm. And so this internationalization, this sense of what had been outside finally coming to knock on the door, the kind of big bad wolf coming to Iceland, that really played into how the case then played out across the media and also in the police investigation.
Mm-hmm. Recordaré ara per la gent un dels fragments que tu reculls a la teva obra quan parles de la caça de brujas, que era un poc una caça de brujas, witch hunter. Dius, teníamos hippies, això et diu un dels testimonis, una de les persones amb les que parles per intentar entendre què va passar amb aquella investigació. Teníamos hippies, música nueva y derechos de la mujer. La nación estaba dividida, así que nos deshicimos de los hippies y los rebeldes.
Yes, well, absolutely, yeah, and it's not an opinion that I think many Icelanders still have today.
No,
but at the time it was, sort of divided along these quite conservative lines versus people who were much more welcome and open to the new influences that were coming into the country. And I think, it's certainly something that you can see in many island nations, take the UK and and what's happening in our country at the moment now, that every now and then there can be this kind of reflexive pushback against outsiders. And I think the 70s in Iceland, you can see this happening in this case, that it was a kind of a pushback against what people thought of as these malign outside influences.
Mm-hmm. I no és només el problema de l'exterior empenyent una nació petita, també tenim el problema de ser una comunitat molt petita. Tothom es coneix i on tothom es coneix també és molt difícil, no ho sé, doncs fer net en segons quines circumstàncies. En el cas aquest que tu comentes, tothom era família de tothom, els jutges, qui obre un cas, si és família del primer jutge que ho va fer, no? Hi havia moltes relacions també dintre del poder que es van mantenir en el temps, perquè no era tan petit que tothom estava sempre als mateixos llocs, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things you see play out in these cases again and again, that the judges who were presiding over the cases were somehow linked to people who'd initially been brought in to be interrogated. It's something you see in all countries, a sort of, I guess you could call it kind of an old boys club or a political elite perhaps, where the same judges and the same politicians all might have gone to the same schools or might know each other, but it's more concentrated in a society where there's, well, back in the 70s, 250,000 people. You know, it's probably less people than are in a particularly busy Barcelona suburb. So when this kind of old boys club does spring up, it's particularly powerful. And that's part of why these cases have ended up continuing for so long, because every time they try to clear their name or they try to push forward new evidence, someone will say, I used to know that person, we shouldn't investigate them, or maybe we should think twice before we pull that person in for interrogation. So the kind of close-knit community, which is such a positive thing in Iceland in so many ways, I think can quite swiftly shade into claustrophobia, especially when the magnifying glass was on people, as it was in these cases.
Mm-hmm. Clar, això és molt similar també al cas de Groenlàndia, en un sentit de que al final Groenlàndia té un territori que, perquè ens fem una idea, ocuparia l'extensió d'Espanya, França, Polònia i Alemanya, però només hi viuen 55.000 persones. És molt poca quantitat de gent, molt distribuïda. Una comunitat tan petita, com gestiona les seves, com amaga o com gestiona en realitat els seus problemes, les seves tragèdies? I parlo, per exemple, dels abusos sexuals o dels suïcidis que es produeixen amb una estadística bastant elevada a Groenlàndia. No sé si em podríeu explicar, Mats o Christopher.
Like I mentioned, my wife worked in the hospital in Umanak, and of course she saw another side that I saw later. So if any of my students were missing, then I would want to know, I would like to, her to tell me if she'd seen them or heard anything. But she had such a loyal sense of, what you call it, when you don't say, you've got a, it's not secrecy act. I'm looking for the word. I can think of it in Danish. Tavshedspligt.
Oh.
Thank you. Sorry. Professionalism. She wasn't allowed to tell me anything. Mm-hmm. So we would play this guessing game. Is this person alive? And she agreed that she would tell me if the person was alive or not. The problem with suicide is that, of course, it's a terrible thing that happens in many Arctic countries and in many other countries. But unfortunately, in Greenland, there can be a sense of that it's almost legitimate. And to understand that, you have to understand that it's a country of extremes. You have extreme weather, you have extreme temperatures, you have extreme prices in the shop. Everything is extreme. So when you are depressed, you're extremely depressed. And when you look for a solution, a lot of people will choose an extreme solution, which unfortunately is suicide. Mm-hmm. Now, I honestly can't remember how many people I know who now have committed suicide. And it unfortunately, it becomes a little bit of routine where you meet someone, you haven't seen one for a few weeks, and you say, oh, how's so-and-so doing? And that person will say, no, they've died, or they're gone. And it becomes part of your life. And when you come back to Denmark, and I was working in a school in Denmark, and someone was complaining because the fridge door hadn't been shut and the milk had gone off. And it's like, yeah, but is anyone dead? So you've got these extremes. And so dealing with suicide is one of those things that, unfortunately, I think like firefighters in Spain would get conditioned to seeing terrible accidents on the motorway. Mm-hmm. You develop a level of hardness, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
It's difficult to add something, but it is, as I said, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was because I gained some knowledge about how many girls was raped in Greenland. And at first, of course, you become very angry and you want to, I don't know, you want to change everything and change the country and change everybody, but you can't change people by force. It takes time. And then one thing you have to learn, as he says, is that you have to understand the very, very different environment where these things are happening. And and when you understand, of course, it's not that you certainly find it okay that people do bad things, but you understand that it's another situation as it would be in Denmark. And it just takes time.
Mm-hmm. Però precisament, Mats, a la teva novel·la tens un personatge femení molt potent. Parla'ns del... Et diré el nom perquè és un nom d'aquests. La protagonista... Oh. M'ho faràs dir, oi?
Tupanak.
Tupanak.
Which is the name?
Tupanak.
Tupanak. Bueno, sona millor així, però escrit és com... Té com 10 lletres. No, no, que bé. Sí. Explica'ns el personatge.
Yes. It's one of the easy Greenlandic words, I would say. Yes. She's actually... I built her upon three of my own friends who themselves have been abused as children. And when you, as a child, are abused for several years, when you grow up, you are not able to be just like normal people because you are destroyed inside and your body is destroyed and you feel that your skin is not yours and you are not able to have relations as other people. So it's very difficult to be a person who has had a childhood like that. And the three friends that I used is, of course, they do know that I used them. One of them is a man at a bit older than me, and he is very, very, very quiet man and so sweet and nice. And the two others are girls, and they are very aggressive persons. One of them very, very strong and with a lot of tattoos, too. So so she is built upon three people who has had lives like my main character. And she was... the reason that I wanted to write the book, and after the book came out, there has been not a lot, but many Greenlandic women writing to me saying, thank you for writing the book, I am like Dubanak, so I was very happy about that.
Yeah. Tu també tens, Christopher, un personatge femení que potser no té encara molt paper a la teva aquesta novel·la, Petra Jensen, l'ajudant de David Maratze, bueno, ajudant, és policia amb ell, Però crec que li destines als nous llibres que tens per publicar, si algú s'anima. Tens més futur per ella. Explica'ns una mica com és la Petra Jensen.
She's I based her almost on one person. and it's one of those situations where there's so few people in Greenland, you really want to say it. But I was inspired by certain people in the police force, and I wanted a strong Greenlandic woman in the same way that Mess wanted a strong Greenlandic woman to tell a story. I chose Petra to tell a story about the fact that she's a Greenlander with two Greenlandic parents, but she also grew up as an orphan in a children's home, but she only speaks Danish. And David Muratsi calls her Pitala, which is the Greenlandic way of saying Petra. And this isn't a spoiler, but he calls her that and she doesn't like it because of the whole identity thing. But really, he's not teasing her. He's identifying her Greenlandicness and making sure that she knows that he knows that she knows in that whole circle. She is very important to me and very important to Muratsi, and she's very important to the future books. She has her own books, which are not connected in this series, but are, well, they are connected, but they're not in the same series. So she's quietly taking over. And I don't want to say too much about how she takes over, but the important thing for me is in my book, in all of the Muratsi books, he might be the main character, but he can't do anything without the people around him. And he recognizes that, even though he doesn't say very much. So.
Tens previst una segona novel·la publicada al castellà? No sé, Blood Fall? Is the name?
If you look in the back of the first book, you'll find that the second book is on its way.
Yes, but it's about Petra Jensen.
It's a Muratsi book. Without, again, it's one of those spoiler situations.
Not a spoiler thing.
No spoilers. Should we just agree that Petra is in these books and she's going to stay in these books?
Okay, it's perfect. I don't need more, I think. Well, maybe people.
All I can say is if you ever get to book three, I'm really, really sorry. But it's important for book four. Does that make sense? Sorry.
Good seller. Algunes de les teves obres més petites, d'aquesta mena de constel·lació de novel·les vinculades a Groenlàndia, parlen sobre la infantesa, sobre els nens d'allà, per poder, d'alguna manera, finançar projectes en aquest sentit, en allà, no?
Yes, I've got my main novels, and then I've written a lot of novellas, about 60 to 80 pages. And each of those has, I tend to put some of my experience in. The things that happen in my books, they're all fiction, but they're based on something. So the book that Carol's talking about is when Muratsi ends up looking after a 9-year-old girl. And she's terrible, but she's lovely, but she's terrible. And she's very difficult to work with. And that just epitomizes the kids that I had in my school or that I worked with. Because, and I mentioned this in Seven Graves, that they are incredibly wild, but they're furious to learn, if that makes sense. They desperately want to learn. But they work at warp speed. If you watch Star Trek or anything, the way they move is fast. But they haven't got time for words. It's all in pictures, but you have to keep up. So it's important for me that I want to talk about these kids who have turned my hair gray, but have also given me incredible experiences that I'll never forget. And I think, you know, that's when I start to get emotional about thinking about the kids I knew in Greenland and what incredible adults they're going to become. Also young people, they're not going to just jump. Even though sometimes you wish they would.
Warp speed.
But at one point we used to say, myself and the other teachers in Greenland, that they're Greenland's future. And they are important to Greenland's future, the children of Greenland. But I think it's also important that they get to determine what they want to do in life. So if they choose to leave Greenland, that's their decision. They're not responsible for Greenland, even though you see some people where you think, yes, that's the next prime minister. So it's a balance. Everything in Greenland is a balance.
El teu true crime, el personatge femení més fort és Erla, però al mateix temps el més feble. Com podries explicar-nos una mica el seu paper i per intentar entendre'l?
Yeah, okay, so the main person that I spoke to for the book, and she's sort of at the heart of the whole story, is a young woman called Etla. She was young in the 70s anyway. She was 20 years old when she was first arrested. And she's brought in on a separate charge. It's nothing to do with these two disappeared men. She's brought in for a fraud charge. And on the sixth day that she's been in custody, she's shown a picture of the first man who disappeared, the man I mentioned who disappeared from the nightclub. And she says that she recognises this man. The police ask her what she remembers about him. And she says, well, I met him at a nightclub one night, and that was the last time I saw him. The police are obviously interested. They ask her, okay, what do you remember from that night? And she says, well, I had this dream. I had this nightmare. So I went home. I went to bed at about 3 or 4 in the morning after the nightclub. And I could see through the window this tree and its branches, its shadow against the blind. And then I fell asleep. And in my dream, Saivar, her boyfriend, and his friends were outside the window, and she could see their shadows against the blind. And against the sound of the storm, she could hear that they were whispering something. They were whispering, is she awake? Is she awake? Is she awake? And then she woke up. And when she woke up, she defecated in her bed. And it was the only time in her life that had ever happened. Mm-hmm. And so the police were obviously suspicious. Because it sounded here like a very strange incident. And from that moment, she ended up implicating quite a lot of people in this man's disappearance, including her own brother. Mm-hmm. And in total, maybe 10 different people ended up serving time either in custody or getting sentences after a court case. So that's kind of the role that she ended up playing in the cases. Today, she's still viewed in some quarters as being someone who misled the police for attention, some people think, or because she was covering up something more wicked. And for others, she's seen as someone who was scapegoated, who was blamed for these things when she shouldn't have been done. Because she was in custody and she'd been compelled into confessing. That's what some people might say. And so today, when you're with her in Iceland, it's very interesting because you can see this division on an everyday basis. So you might be in a cafe, walk in with her, and you'll see people turn. It's a small society, everyone knows everyone, and you'll see people whispering about her and, trying to kind of pick her out and point to her with their friends. And in other circumstances, people will celebrate her as a hero and say that they believe her and that they believe she is innocent. So she's this very divisive figure in Iceland still today.
Wow. És una història fascinant, realment, la que expliques a la teva obra. Un tema que també, d'alguna manera, enllaça els vostres tres llibres és una mica aquesta sensació de que les illes, perquè al final són illes, estan potser en el lloc geogràfic més inconvenient pels interessos mundials econòmics. I diries tu, si aquestes illes estiguessin situades a un altre punt del globus, segurament no tindrien els problemes que tenen, estarien més deixades de la mà de Déu. Ningú no voldria anar-hi allà i ningú no tindria interessos estratègics. A la teva obra, al teu llibre, parles de l'època de la Guerra Fria, com els hi va afectar els interessos russos, els interessos dels nord-americans. I això afecta una comunitat molt petita que no tindria per què tenir cap tipus de valor. Pots explicar-nos una miqueta més? aquest influx.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I think it's something that people who don't know much about Iceland find surprising. I certainly found it surprising that it's this country that seems kind of in the middle of nowhere, right at the top of the Atlantic Ocean or what have
with
you.
With no army, this is a special thing because you are in OTAN or maybe, no?
Exactly, yeah, and it's neutral. You would expect that it wouldn't have necessarily played a particularly important role in global conflicts. But you go back through the Cold War, you go back through the Second World War, and you know, everyone wants to occupy Iceland, even though it's a neutral country without an army, like you say. So, yeah, I mean, in the Second World War, the British army, British ships, just turned up on the Icelandic shore one day, marched ashore and started banging up notices on doors around the city saying that the English had arrived, took over the radio station and broadcast to say that, you know, the English occupation of the Allied occupation of Iceland had begun. By the following year, there was an American air base, and suddenly you have, you know, kind of Wendy's and burger joints and soldiers dancing the foxtrot and trying to sleep with Icelandic women, all happening in this city in Reykjavik, which had previously been very isolated and very insulated from the world. So in that sense, Iceland, despite being this kind of country, this island kind of which might look in the middle of nowhere on the map, ends up being this place of huge strategic importance when there's global warfare.
Bueno, i Dinamarca no està massa lluny en això. Fa no gaire, Donald Trump ens sorprenia a tots dient que tenia interès a comprar Groenlàndia. No sé si recordeu, ara ens hem oblidat, però es valia bastant. I els xinesos també tenen grans interessos estratègics per creuar la zona de l'Àrtic, aprofitant també el canvi climàtic. Tota aquesta situació, d'alguna manera, està alimentant també la vostra ficció, la vostra manera d'interpretar el que passa, perquè està passant realment, està afectant la gent allà, no? Christopher?
Can I, you want that one?
In my second book, that there's a lot about this because, of course, Greenland is protected by Danish military, but it's American muscles behind. And there are American bases in Greenland. And when America has military bases in a country, they see it as American military area. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to politicians behind closed doors, there is some kind of knowledge that if Greenland someday were to become totally independent of Denmark, America would probably overtake Greenland the same day because America would never allow Chinese or Russians' interest to go into to Greenland. Does it affect? Normally it doesn't, but at the time when Trump wanted to buy Greenland, of course a lot of people were writing about it, but I'm quite sure that Denmark would never sell an island with people living on it. It seems quite stupid and inhuman even to ask.
No.
But I went to a Danish military talk where they're actually recruiting for Arctic Command, which is based in Nuuk but has the military, they coordinate the military of across the whole of Greenland and across to the Faroes, yes. And they also go a lot across to Iceland. Yes. But they were talking about how there is a lot of interest in the Arctic. It is very strategic. So no matter what you think about Trump, and believe me, I've got lots of opinions, he does have a point that it's very strategic. But what they were saying was that there's an island called Novaya Zemlya, I think that's how you say it, a Russian island to the east of Greenland. Mm-hmm. And it's very curious that the Russians, they told us this in the talk, it's very curious that the Russians have built a tourist installation to encourage tourism. But the tourists that come, usually they're usually about 60 of them. They're between 20 and 30 years old. They're all men, and they're very, very fit. So you've got to ask, you know, what kind of tourists are they encouraging to go to this island? And the basic point is that the Arctic is vulnerable. And unfortunately, I think with the Americans and the Chinese and the Danish and everybody else, they're all fighting over this huge territory. And as the sea ice retreats, it will become more and more attractive. And the Greenlandic people are going to be held hostage to whichever superpower is going to be strongest in that area. And it's a frightening scenario that I hope never comes to be, but it's going to be the Greenlandic people who suffer. And Trump proved that when he said it's a real estate deal. He just kind of forgot that there were people there. Mm. So this, I think it's very sad.
Sí, suposo que han de buscar un equilibri entre el que pot ser raonablement beneficiós, perquè també han de viure I han d'aconseguir beneficis, no? I una altra cosa és el que ja és una invasió, una intromissió o un efecte global, perquè viure de caçador, que és el que volen fer les comunitats inuit, per exemple, pràcticament viuen d'això. Quines professions més... És la cultura seva busca intentar mantenir-se en el temps, Mats? La manera de viure que tenen allà, creus que és sostenible en el temps?
When I lived in Karnak, which is right at the top, it's about 800 miles from the North Pole, so it's quite far. There are a lot of hunters there, yeah. But the ice is getting thinner, even in Karnak. But the smart hunters were moving to fishing. And when I say smart hunters, I don't mean in terms of intelligence, I just mean in terms of business. They recognized that there was a lot of money to be made in fishing. So while the hunters were very proud of their tradition, if they didn't adapt and change to another form of income, which was also available, then they will, their tradition will unfortunately die out. But it's important to remember that in Karnak as well, when they hunt whales, they are legally bound to hunt them from a kayak, which is an old skin frame kayak made from seal skin, but now cotton, built around a wooden frame. So they're not allowed to shoot whales from boats. So they have to, they go out like little aircraft carriers full of kayaks, and they sail out, put the kayaks in the water, and go after the whales. But further down, you're allowed to hunt whales from boats, from speedboats. So even in Greenland, there's a difference between what you're allowed to do in the different areas, which really affects the subsistence hunting and the way of life.
Mm-hmm. La teva segona novel·la tindrà alguna cosa a veure sobre les balenes? No és un spoiler, eh?
No spoilers. yes, whales are a big part of... what I try to do is build in a part of the culture that I've seen and experienced in Greenland. So in the second book, it's called Blood Flow, as in an ice flow, because when you see a whale butchered on the ice, there's an awful lot of blood. The whales are important because if you go to a country like Greenland and you have an opinion about hunting, and if your opinion isn't the same as the Greenlanders, you're never going to integrate. So I chose when I was in Greenland to basically say, I'm here to learn about your culture and I will look at it with your eyes, and that's part of what I try to do in the second book.
Haurem d'esperar també el segon llibre, però abans tenim també un segon llibre del Mats Peder que crec que està en camí, en castellà també, I abans encara podem anar-los a firmar ara quan sortim d'aquí perquè estaran els autors... fora fent dedicatòries a tots els llibres que compreu, que espero que siguin molts. En fi, crec que ja podem donar per acabada la taula d'avui, la taula freda. Farà més fred que quan hem entrat, perquè és una qüestió de meteorologia I que ja és de nit. Però volia agrair-vos molt la vostra presència aquí I a tots vosaltres per estar també aquí escoltant-nos I participant d'aquesta tarda. Gràcies.